Three distinguished diplomats met earlier today with Steve McCormick on the American Forum to present their viewpoints on the crisis in the Middle East. Because it is impossible to approach any crisis intelligently without hearing and weighing the views of many people, Monitor sat in on the American Forum, and we bring it to you now.
Tension and the fear of war this week gripped nations and peoples throughout the world. As conflict continued in the Middle East, attention turned to the United Nations in New York, and the hope for a quick and effective end to the fighting. As of today, the UN police force is waiting for Egyptian consent to land in that country. Today on the American Forum, we are proud to present three key men in the search for peace. Abba Eban, ambassador of Israel, whose nation agreed this week to withdraw its troops from the Sinai Peninsula. Sir Leslie Monroe, ambassador of New Zealand, first country to offer troops for the UN police force in Egypt. And RSS Gunawardene, ambassador of Ceylon, a member of the advisory committee for the police force. Well, gentlemen, there are many aspects to this question today. May I begin with this one? Do you feel that the present Middle East situation contains the seed of World War III? May I start with you, Ambassador Abba Eban?
Mr. McCormick, I think the danger does exist, but I think that insofar as we have weakened Nasserism, we have reduced that danger. This fascist dictatorship, arming itself to the teeth with the aid of a foreign power, that threatened Israel with destruction, the Middle East and Africa with hegemony, and Europe with economic subjection. If Nasserism is revived, if it is brought back in command of the Suez Canal, then peace and freedom will be threatened in the Middle East, in Africa, in Europe, and in the world.
Sir Leslie Monroe, may I ask you the same question, sir?
I refuse, really, to envisage, Mr. McCormick, a Third World War. And I can't believe, if all the countries are sensible and moderate, that there could be one. And I say that because I think that the situation was first of all stabilized by the Anglo-French peace action, which moved in at any rate before the United Nations was ready to do so. Then I am encouraged by the fact that a United Nations force is established. And finally, I feel that if Egypt accepts this force, and I profoundly hope she does, and if Russia does not intervene, and that is another supremely important condition, then there should be no world war. And for Egypt not to accept the force is almost unthinkable, and I cannot believe, as a human being desirous of peace, that Russia would intervene, although there is room for concern at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Gunawardene, sir, how do you feel about this?
So there has been always a seed of World War III for some time, but I'm inclined to the view that we can resolve these differences that exist quite effectively through the United Nations. Sir Leslie rightly pointed out, the English and the French had consented to abide by the verdict of the United Nations, and we're also glad to hear the news that Israel too has consented to accept that decision, insofar as the ceasefire and withdrawal of troops are concerned. In view of that, I do not think the danger lies now. There is no doubt that the Russian has a definite interest in the Middle East and would be only glad to come in on any excuse. The excuse will not appear now.
You don't think it will appear now?
No.
Well, of course, there has been said that the withdrawal has sort of reached a stalemate, that actually the Anglo-French and Israeli troops are installing in this affair. And we've read this in today's paper that the Russians claim this at least. Is this true, Ambassador Eban?
Well, we shall stand by the undertaking which we've given to the United Nations. But I will say this, that simply to withdraw and leave a vacuum for disorder, for anarchy, for a renewal of fighting, for a renewal of blockades, this would be the worst thing that could happen, and it's very wise, therefore, on the part of my government, and I think of the other two governments concerned, to coordinate their action in withdrawing their troops with the arrival of the United Nations force in order to avoid this vacuum of anarchy.
Sir Leslie.
What I was about to say, Mr. McCormick, is this. You asked a question about the Anglo-French forces, and of course I can't reply for them. But it has been specifically stated in the United Nations by them that they will withdraw when there is an effective international force there, that they will not withdraw until that effective force is actually there. And my government, of course, thoroughly understands that position. And as you say, we've offered to contribute to a force. But that force must be in this vital area effectively before the Anglo-French troops leave the place.
Is that not the reason, sir, that the Soviets claim that that you are, therefore, not pulling out rapidly enough, and therefore they have given their approval to these so-called volunteers to move into the area?
Well, I dare say they do. They're champions at making mischief of this kind. I, for my part, have never heard that they're ready to withdraw troops from Hungary when there's an effective international force there to supervise free elections. I've never heard them make the slightest suggestion. I consider that they're making mischief because, as Ambassador Eban says, they must know full well that if the Anglo-French forces leave immediately, then, of course, there may be disturbances. There will be no security for the free world that we can advance towards the long-range settlement, which we now all so much desire.
Is this a big bluff, do you feel, gentlemen, on their part, or is it along the line of what we heard was called a big bluff when the communist troops from China moved into Korea?
I venture to disagree with the point of view just expressed by Sir Leslie Mundo and my very distinguished friend, Mr. Abba Iban. My view is that the Anglo-French troops and the Israeli troops must withdraw immediately, because where the police force is concerned, it's ready to take over any moment, so that they didn't worry about what is going to happen next. The question is now before the assembly, and the Security Council and the assembly move quickly enough for any effective action these days. We are in emergency session until now, and we will be in session from 12th. Any question can be considered. I cannot see where the danger can come if the Israeli troops withdraw and the Anglo-French troops withdraw, where the danger can come from, unless the Egyptians think of making an attack. But of course, the Egyptians cannot be considered to dream of it just at this moment. Well, you give room for the Russian troops to come in if there's any delay in the withdrawal of the troops.
Mr. Iban, what is the answer to that?
Well, I'd like to explain why I think a precipitate withdrawal as regards Israel would be quite catastrophic. If we simply withdrew with no arrangements about the political and military situation that would thereafter ensue, you would again have Fedayeen units coming into our country. You would again have the Egyptian army right up to our frontier. You would again have blockade activities in the Gulf of Aqaba. In other words, you would recreate all the conditions for the new explosion. You would be putting the gunpowder and the match together once again.
You don't feel so, Ambassador Gunawardene?
I certainly feel an overall solution of the question is necessary, but a political solution or a military solution being possible within the next few days or within the next few months is a far-fetched one.
So, Leslie.
Well, can I say this? I feel that what we've got to deal with now, and so Ambassador Gunawardene is dealing with it, but what I want to stress is that we've got to deal now with the present and the future. I'm not so much concerned with what happened in the past, although, of course, it has a great bearing. I feel we're not going to get a settlement here, we're not going to get peace and stability, unless we get a settlement of the Suez Canal problem and unless we get a settlement of the Palestinian problem. And we have very great difficulties. My colleague, the ambassador of Ceylon, says that he translates the word immediately as being at once, now they get out. Now, there are a great many of the assembly who would understand his point of view, who said that they construed immediately as when the effective forces moved in. But let me mention two things which are of grave seriousness to the whole free world. The first is that the canal is blocked and probably cannot be cleared for 4 months. And the second is that the oil position affecting Western Europe is one of the utmost gravity. There's one pipeline already blocked. So that out of this situation, we've got to try to extract good, and we've got to settle those problems that I've mentioned. We've got to clear the canal, and we've got to see that oil runs to Western Europe or its industry will come to a grinding stop.
Well, how are the timing, and this is very important. How will this be done, Mr. Ambassador?
My own view is, if you wait for the solution of these two problems, there's no doubt the Suez Canal problem must be solved. The Palestine question must be solved. We're all for it. I don't think this problem should have been allowed to go on for such a long time. Somehow they're dragged on. If we wait for the effective solution to these problems, then will be the finest reason for Russia to step in, and placed in the position in which Egypt is, desperate as she is, she'll be only too glad to accept any assistance. And if that assistance is accepted, well, you are just laying the foundation of World War III.
Can I say a word on this, Soviet aspect? Now, the United Nations is dealing with this question, and the question of the ceasefire and the agreed withdrawal of forces, these are matters in which the United Nations collectively negotiates with the parties, and no one member, however strong or powerful, has the right to say that because things are not going quickly enough, I'm going to step in order to expedite the process. And I think we ought not to pay any moral attention to this threat, because it has no legal or moral basis behind it at all.
Well, look, Mr. McCormick, what we have achieved. I know my friend over here, as he is my friend, does not agree with the Anglo-French action, whereas we do. And one thing that is interesting is he and I are both members of the Commonwealth. We can differ. I've never heard of a satellite differing from Russia, where Mr. Gunnar Wadden and I have got that great privilege. Now, the Anglo-French forces have come in, and there are no further advances by the forces of Israel, so that you have that degree of stabilization. You have a United Nations force about to be established. It's not established yet. I don't want to have to see any vacuum there. And surely the best guarantee of Egypt's security is the presence of troops, none of which will represent any one of the great powers. And why should Russia be in a position any different from any other of the great powers once that force is established?
The point I make is this. The presence of foreign troops must necessarily be a source of irritation to Egypt. And piqued as she is, it's bound to resent it. And the verdict of the United Nations Assembly must be taken into account. There's no question about, there's no timing in that resolution. The resolution plainly and simply says it's military operations conducted against Egyptian territory. And they must withdraw immediately. Immediately, of course, is interpreted by various nations various ways. But I can assure you the vast majority of the nations do believe that they must go away quickly. If they go away quickly, the threat doesn't come from Israel. From whom comes the threat?
Well, I'd like to say, I'm sure my good friend, the ambassador of Ceylon, would agree that it's not only a question of Egypt being irritated. It's irritating for Israel to have these Fedayeen bands come and kill our people. It's irritating for the maritime nations to have a blockade established in the Suez Canal and in the Gulf of Aqaba. It is because so many interests were outraged by Nasserism that this explosion has taken place. And all I'm saying is that in solving this problem, along the lines agreed by the United Nations, we must not reconstruct those sources of irritation by creating the sort of vacuum which would arise if a withdrawal were to be effected without any care as to what was to happen on the morrow of the withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. There could be some understanding, I always urge, of Britain and of France. They are the two countries who have given freedom to more countries probably than any nation in modern history. What has always worried me is that there's not more indignation throughout parts of the world so far as Hungary is concerned. I know my good friend over here does not approve of aggression in Hungary, but the fact of the matter is that hostility towards Britain and France and a misunderstanding of their motives is the very thing that plays into the hands of the Russians in the Middle East. And we have had great provocations there. We've had a seizure of the canal company, which was sudden, it was abrupt, and in my opinion, it was illegal. And we have had every reason, Britain and France have had every reason to form a profound mistrust. And now, reluctantly, and lately, too, they moved in to stabilize the situation, as I repeat, out of which good may come, and this may be our last opportunity of getting good and getting results for the permanent settlement of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I disagree on that point. England and France, whatever the cause of irritation may have been, had no business to go there. There was the United Nations, the Security Council. They are two permanent members of the Security Council. They were not seized to the problem. They had not consulted at least the fellow members of the Commonwealth, so far as I know. They had not consulted the Baghdad Pact. They had not consulted the NATO command. They hadn't consulted any of their friends. They take unilateral action just because they felt that they have certain rights to protect. Well, what is the United Nations for? What are all these pacts for? Except for working in a common cause, for the security of goodwill and peace in the world. Having done that on their own account, when you find from all quarters that their action was not justified, that's a clear verdict of the United Nations resolution, then I think a country, a nation like England, which always believed in the maintenance of law and order, which always has upheld the provisions of the Charter, should abide by it and act on it. That is the surest way of creating goodwill.
I'm not going to get into this question of the justifications of the Anglo-French action. I hold no brief for them. But for Israel, I'll say this. We had 200 meetings of the Security Council over the past few years, endless meetings of the General Assembly. And at the end of it all, our people were murdered in their homes, our shipping was seized in the Gulf of Aqaba, our commerce was obstructed in the international waterway, we were threatened with aggression from three sides, and I've no doubt that our action was both necessary and just.
Gentlemen, yes, Sir Leslie,
well,
point.
I've been a lawyer for some time, and anybody who has a reasonable apprehension of imminent danger has the duty to intervene in self-protection. That is what the United States did in Korea, and we approved of it. There have been other places where other countries have intervened. Britain had a very big base in Egypt, which she evacuated, and she had the right to go in there if there was an attack launched. Now, it is true there was not an attack from outside the area, but there was an intervention, and that's a word which perhaps my friend, the ambassador of Israel, would appreciate, but there was certainly a great incursion which threatened that base.
Mm. Well, gentlemen, there is one question that I must bring up. It's a rather frank question, but it's arisen so many times since this has happened in the last 10 days that I must ask it and get your opinion. There have been claims there was collusion between the nations who moved into Egypt. Is that true or is it not true? Ambassador Eber.
Israel's action was undertaken for Israeli interests and on behalf of Israel's security, and we have no responsibility whatever for any action which converged upon ours or which coincided with it. We take our stand on the right of our country to ensure its self-defense, to be free of murderous incursions and of acts of war at sea, and those were the sole motives which animated our action, and I must say I've been deeply moved by a great volume of opinion expressed throughout the world in sympathy with the unique and somber story of this little country besieged and embattled and provoked to a maddening degree for the past 8 years. We take our stand on the independent merits of our action.
Sir Leslie, I want you to have an opportunity, sir, to express yourself.
Well, I'm very happy to have an opportunity. I'm a diplomat now of some years standing, and I know the events of the last few months. And I am certain, as my government is certain, that there was no collusion whatever between the government of Israel and the government of the United Kingdom. What was the interest of the government of the United Kingdom? To establish international control of the zone. It had been trying to do so for weeks and was getting nowhere, and was not getting anywhere either in the Security Council because its most effective proposals were vetoed. Then, when there was the intervention by Israel, provoked as it no doubt was in many ways, when it did occur, then Britain moved in to protect her vital interest in those of the West, mm-hmm. but without any collusion, believe me.
Well, gentlemen, after the United Nations police force performs its mission, which, as I understand it, is to secure and supervise the withdrawal of Anglo-French and Israeli forces, what then? Who will run the canal? Will we have a peace? What will then happen, Ambassador Gunawardene? What's the next step?
Oh, the next step necessarily must be a solution of the problem of the Suez Canal and the Palestine question. I'm all for it. All nations must unite. They make a united effort, because this problem has been the root of all the troubles.
Will the United Nations be able to pull these parties together, do you feel?
Well, given goodwill, I suppose, in cooperation on the part of all nations, I'm still optimistic.
Is that the way you see it?
Well, we're profound believers in New Zealand of the United Nations. I've been sitting in committees dealing with the Palestinian problem for a long time, and I haven't seen the parties get together. I haven't seen direct negotiations between them, and we're most anxious to see that there should be a conference, and if we can't establish that, then we can't get peace in the Middle East, and the peace of the world is continually in jeopardy.
Ambassador Abbott, I would agree with that, Mr. McCormick, and I think there's no time to be lost. If after this very critical and explosive week, we were to go back to a situation in which the Suez Canal is not regulated by international law, in which blockade practices still continue, to a position in which Egypt and Israel have no affirmative relations between them, I think we will have failed to rise to the level of our opportunity. I think the slogan now is not backward to belligerency, but forward to peace, a negotiated settlement between Egypt and Israel and the application of international law in the Suez Canal.
Do you feel, sir, that a peace settlement would change the opinion of a good part of the world, which rather resents the fact that Israel and Egypt and Britain moved, Britain and France moved in on Egypt in the last week or so? We read of the feeling of throughout the world that a good many people don't like this. And would a peace settlement change that feeling?
I think if there was a peace settlement, everybody would understand that what was done was on Israel's part was necessary and wise. As regards world resentment, there's another side to the picture. As regards Israel, there's a great chivalrous surge of sympathy with us. And as regards those who do not comprehend what we have done, I think it's purely a question of geographical remoteness. If in this hemisphere, for example, a dictatorial regime were established with assistance by subversive forces from far abroad and which attempted to extend its hegemony over its neighbor and which sent its armed units raiding into neighboring states, I wonder if countries in this hemisphere would not have felt at a certain time that they had to take a certain security action.
Mm. Well, a lot of people, so, you know, a lot of people, Mr. McCormick, object to the use of the word police. Now, we all like the police in our own countries. If we don't like them, we at any rate respect them, and we know how necessary they are. And this is where my friend, the ambassador of Ceylon, would disagree with me, because he would resent, I know, the idea that any peace-loving power like Britain should be an international policeman. But if police action is necessary, and if the United Nations is unable to do it, then I am content that that police action should have been taken urgently as it was, and I think you will see, as time goes on, there will be a more adequate appreciation of what was done. A peace settlement, of course, would be the answer, but that's something we've all got to work for and not brood on the past.
Sir, Ambassador Gunawardene.
If each nation believes that he can be the most effective policeman, there'll be no peace in the world. Because it will be the excuse. In the case of England, it may be with justification. It may be some other nation without any kind of justification. We try to be a policeman. And that will certainly not help the United Nations. I certainly think that the effectiveness of the United Nations depends on realizing the strength of the United Nations, making it, if it is not strong enough, to make it stronger, and not weaken it by taking independent unilateral action without reference to the United Nations.
On this question of peace, I would like to say a word in which I think the presence of my friend from Ceylon is very relevant. We will not get peace unless Egypt and the other Arab countries recognize Israel's statehood, Israel's sovereignty, Israel's charter rights, and the duty of all member states to negotiate an agreement on their conflicts. And I think here the countries of Asia, which have such strong links with our Arab neighbors, have a great role to play in persuading Egypt and other Arab countries of their duty to negotiate their differences with us by the processes laid down in the Charter.
But let us above all, Mr. McCormick, get that canal working and let get oil flowing, because if it doesn't, the countries of Western Europe will suffer, my country will suffer, your country will suffer, Mr. Gunnar.
How will we get the canal open here, say, in the next few weeks now, the police... let's assume the police force moves in the next week or two and takes over.
It will take 3 months, I suppose, even so.
You think it will take 3 months, sir?
It will take months to clear it.
All right.
And well, so the action didn't help.
Who'll do the clearing now?
But that's the physical problem. I think more important when the physical problem has been solved is the political problem, to place the canal under such a regime as will make it impossible for any one nation to decide that it will close and open the canal for other nations at will.
You don't feel that Egypt wants to open the canal, do you, as at this stage?
She sunk ships in it, which blocked it.
And she closed the canal to our shipping illegally for 6 years.
But honestly, gentlemen, do you think Egypt voluntarily now will go and open the canal?
Egypt will be only too glad to open the canal for the simple reason that's their lifeblood. They have revenue from it. They will cease to get revenue.
Do you think that might happen, sir, now that the UN police force is moving in?
Yes.
You think it might?
I think if the United Nations police force does not take care of this question of free navigation in the canal, then its chief purpose will not have been fulfilled. I would say that that is the chief purpose which a United Nations force can usefully achieve.
Mm-hmm. I see. I freely grant that an agreement has to be reached with regard to this point. I assure you, by my colleague from Israel, that the Asian nations are very greatly pained over the state of affairs that have existed for a number of years between the Arab states and Israel. A good many of us do recognize the state of Israel, and we also think that that fact, of course, has to be recognized, and we have got to go on a basis of equality to all states, and effort must be made to bring them all round together for a conference and have a negotiated settlement. I certainly think it will come.
All the goodwill in the world never stopped Mr. Nasser nationalizing the canal, though.
Yes, but there's some hope of, there are certain, you know, the establishment of the principles already laid down. It is a further, it's an advance from the position
it
was. And from that point onwards, without a hasty action, you probably might have achieved a little more.
It is an advance, but various things have taken place.
I would say that Sir Leslie has put his finger on the main issue, which is the nature and the character of Nasser and of Nasserism. And it was our experience living close at hand to this regime that its policies and objectives were hostile to peace with Israel, hostile to a free canal, hostile to freedom in Africa and in Europe. And if there has been successful and glorious resistance to this blackmailing dictatorship, we may have taken a step towards conciliation and peace.
Was this one of your main objectives in moving into Egypt, sir? And have you achieved those objectives?
We've achieved one objective. We've made ourselves a little more secure. We've made it less likely that an attack will be launched on us from Egypt. We have opened the Gulf of Aqaba. There are other objectives which have not been secured: a negotiation between Israel and Egypt for peace, and the securing of our rights in the Suez Canal.
Because understand, I'm not commenting on Colonel Nasser. This was a police action so far as Britain and France were concerned. What I'm looking forward to now is peaceful cooperation with all parties if we can secure it.
Let us trust that we'll achieve that, gentlemen. And thank you very much for being with me today. I must interrupt, our time is up. Our guests today have been, and we thank them very much, Abba Eben, Ambassador of Israel, Sir Leslie Munro, Ambassador of New Zealand, RSS Gunawadini, Ambassador of Ceylon. The nation's first discussion program, the American Forum, is now in its 28th year, founded and produced by Theodore Granick. This is Steve McCormick bidding you goodbye.
For reprints of today's discussion on the American Forum, send 10 cents to Ransdell Incorporated, Printers and Publishers, Washington 18, D.C. The American Forum is produced by its founder, Theodore Granick, directed by Frank Slingland. This program came to you from the NBC studios in Washington. This is Ray Quinn speaking. This has been an NBC presentation.